Hello and welcome back to the Studio Canal Presents podcast. My name is Simon Brew from Film Stories magazine, and this is a regular podcast celebrating one of the biggest and deepest film libraries in the world. Studio Canal's extensive catalogue of films brings together cinema from around the globe, going back over a century. The full library is over 6,000 titles strong, with films from Hammer horror classics and Kill List through to St. Maud and Train to Busan. And we're going to do our very best to explore it all in this podcast. Now, across the last few months, we've explored The French New Wave, The Third Man, the cinematic majesty of Arnold Schwarzenegger. But now, well, the nights are drawing in, the leaves are falling outside, it's spooky season. And we wanted to bring you a special bonus episode dedicated to the maestro of American horror, John Carpenter. Braving the murky fog and the scary people gathering outside one particular church for this episode is a man renowned for his courage in the face of horror cinema. It's Mike Munzer, the voice and brains behind the Evolution of Horror podcast and also my deadly rival in the iTunes podcast charts. Now, very shortly, we're going to be talking all things John Carpenter with him, from the horror to the sci-fi to the politics to one of the finest action sequences in 1980s cinema. But first, well, we'll be back on the other side of this clip from Carpenter's 1988 sci-fi satire, They Live.
I have come here to chew bubblegum and kick ass. And I'm all out of bubblegum.
Oh, shit. Oh.
A very big welcome to you, Mike, to Studio Canal Presents. And just for your easy opening question, can you introduce John Carpenter for us, for those who may not be familiar with his work, and kind of explain why he's become such an icon of horror cinema in particular?
Yeah, I mean, John Carpenter is, I think for all of us that are into horror, he is a legend, isn't he? So obviously he is a filmmaker that really kind of peaked, I would say, around the sort of late 70s into the late 80s, had this incredible kind of 10-year span of genre movies. He grew up as a big film nerd, really, you know, like so many filmmakers of that generation. You know, he grew up watching movies by people like Howard Hawks and John Ford, but also kind of B-movies, monster movies of the 1950s, that kind of thing. And you can kind of see that in the movies that he makes. You know, he started off making these kind of very low-budget sci-fi kind of monster alien movies like Dark Star, and then kind of progress through different types of horror movies, action films. I would defy anyone to come up with a better streak of movies, you know, sort of run of movies than John Carpenter's during the 70s and 80s, you know, going from Assault on Precinct 13 to Halloween to The Fog to Escape from New York, The Thing, Christine, Starman, Big Trouble in Little China, Prince of Darkness, and They Live. That's quite a run, Simon, isn't it?
I mean, 8 out of 10, it's not bad, is it? So I trust you have a classier response to this question than my own, because my first encounter with John Carpenter films was one of his lesser works, Memoirs of an Invisible Man, which I wouldn't desperately take a long drive to go and try and find a DVD of. What was your first encounter with his films?
I fell in love with the horror genre probably when I was far too young to fall in love with it. I was probably about 10 or 11 years old. I grew up in the 1990s watching movies like Scream and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, from a movie like Wes Craven's Scream, you can sort of make a list of titles of other films, you know, that they talk about or that they reference. So I sought out Halloween. I think I got somebody to rent it from our local video store for me.
Terrible behaviour. I would never did anything like that.
I know, outrageous. And watched it on my own in the dark. I can remember it so clearly in my living room, and the film absolutely terrified me, and I still find it terrifying to this day. But John Carpenter was pivotal in my falling in love with the horror genre, and after Halloween I kind of sought out every other John Carpenter film that I could.
There were two things for me that really struck me about John Carpenter early, once I'd got past Memoirs of an Invisible Man.
Yeah.
Number one is inevitably the music, which I'll come back to a little bit. But also, I can't think of many other directors who have their own font.
Font, exactly. Yeah, that's right. I think It's undeniably a John Carpenter movie when you watch a John Carpenter movie. Like you say, the music, the font, even the story, you know, so many of his movies have that kind of, again, I think it goes back to people like Howard Hawks, but that idea of a group of characters stuck in a place with some kind of evil either inside or outside, right? Yeah. And there is that kind of almost sort of siege narrative with a lot of his movies. Yeah, you can see his stamp all over everything he does, I think, you know.
I've never asked people about fonts on this podcast before, but, you know, there is a first time. You can imagine the impact of his movies would be lessened if he opened them with Comic Sans or something like that.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a good font, isn't it? That's the thing, you know?
Yeah, I wouldn't bring up a font if I didn't think it was worth noting, certainly.
Strong font.
You talked there about, and it almost sounds like circumstance for him a little bit, that he was working on relatively tight budgets, and a lot of his films put a big ensemble in one contained place.
Yeah.
And I think of something like The Fog, which is almost like a fireside ghost story, isn't it, at heart?
Mm-hmm.
But can you introduce The Fog for us and just explain how that characters under siege thing works there?
Yeah, so, I mean, you say it's like a campfire ghost story. I mean, that is sort of literally what it is, isn't it? The movie begins with an old man sitting around a campfire sort of introducing this story to these kids.
100 years ago, on the 21st of April, out on the waters around Spivey Point, a small clipper ship drew toward land.
Essentially, the story, it's quite a nice, simple one, right? It is this foreboding, unearthly fog which rolls into this kind of coastal town. This fog is kind of shrouding these monsters, these kind of ghost, zombie, pirate people who completely kind of menace this town and its inhabitants. It's a great ensemble cast in The Fog. You've got Adrian Barbeau, Jamie Lee Curtis, Janet Leigh, Tom Atkins, and a bunch of other people who kind of have to haul up in various different buildings as a church and various other places in order to survive these fog monsters, essentially. It's a kind of classic ghost story, but mixed in with sort of slasher elements as well, almost, you know? And again, it feels very quintessentially John Carpenter in that regard.
Is it almost a repertory company of actors he was working with across some of these films?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, obviously, by this point, he had worked with Jamie Lee Curtis in Halloween. Adrian Barbeau, I think, were they married at this point? They were definitely married at some point. I don't know whether they were married at the time of making this. You can absolutely tell that he has his kind of repertoire of actors that people loved working with him again and again as well.
Six must die. That was on
the three men on the seagrass.
And the weatherman is four.
Is this Culbridge?
Yep, five.
And one of us,
that's what they want. They've come back for the six original conspirators.
Six other lines to take the place.
The fascinating story with The Fog that always got me was the fact that he went a bit World War Z on it, didn't he? That he basically reworked a third of the film in post-production, I read.
Yeah, that's really interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, with a lot of those types of movies, you know, World War Z, for example, you can kind of feel that when you watch it, right? You can feel when a movie has problems. It doesn't feel that way to me, you know? There's something that feels so slick and simple in a wonderful way about The Fog. And again, about so many of Carpenter's movies of this era, you know, they are simple in a kind of glorious way. I don't think I ever would have guessed that just watching The Fog, you know?
I mean, it's even more impressive that it wasn't like he was juggling enormous resources that he could go into post-production and do that level of surgery on it. And I don't think there was studio pressure either. It was him not happy with it.
Yeah, that's right. And again, you know, he was working on small budgets, and I think which kind of meant that there was less studio pressure on him generally at this point in his career.
Yeah.
I think for whatever reason, that was him, you know, making those changes. And I think whatever decisions he made, they were clearly the right decisions because the film comes together beautifully. And also we should mention Deborah Hill as well. I mean, Deborah Hill co-wrote the movie with him.
Yes,
she was his real kind of partner in filmmaking, you know, in these early years. She also wrote the script for Halloween with John Carpenter. They were a really great pairing, I think. You know, Deborah Hill's dialogue often is kind of the more prominent dialogue in a lot of these early Carpenter movies.
Would you say that The Fog is a good entry-level Carpenter for those who've not experienced his work before?
I would, actually. Yeah, I think it does. It ticks all of the boxes. I think the film looks gorgeous, and that's another thing about Carpenter. He works with yes. cinematographers like Dean Cundey, who, again, just like create these beautiful, haunting images. Like, you know, the lighting in this film, I think, is absolutely gorgeous. It's got that Carpenter music, beautiful score. It's got this big ensemble. It's creepy, it's jumpy, it's a perfect kind of spooky season movie, for one thing. And yeah, it is a great entry into Carpenter's filmography, I would say.
I would suggest, and I see to you as the expert on this, that probably the toughest one to get into, and the one not to come to completely cold, was at the end, towards the end of this run, with Prince of Darkness.
Yes.
And I think Prince of Darkness is a film that's rightly found its acclaim now, but it's a tough one, isn't it?
It is. It's a very strange beast, isn't it? Prince of Darkness. It is this strange story of this Catholic priest played by Donald Pleasance who invites these sort of quantum physicists, right?
Yes.
To this kind of abandoned old church where there is this mysterious, strange green liquid with sort of supernatural or scientific properties, and it starts to kind of possess people. You know, what Carpenter was doing, as always, is kind of paying homage to storytellers and filmmakers that he grew up with. And there is clearly a big Nigel Neal influence in Prince of Darkness, right?
Yeah.
Nigel Neal obviously being this horror TV writer who did things like Quatermass, later on stuff like The Stone Tape. And he was very famous for mixing supernatural chills with science and science fiction. And Carpenter is kind of very clearly paying homage to that. Even his screenwriting credit, he's called himself Martin Quatermass in the credits,
yeah,
which is interesting because Carpenter and Nigel Neal actually didn't have a great working relationship.
I heard this. I mean, it's the whole thing of don't meet your heroes, right?
It's so sad. Yeah, so obviously Carpenter produced some of the early Halloween sequels. He didn't direct them, but he sort of had a hand in writing and producing Halloween 3, Season of the Witch, which is that famous outlier Halloween film that has nothing to do with Michael Myers. And Nigel Neal actually came on board to write it with him. And there is a real Nigel Neal vibe to Halloween 3. But Nigel Neal hated working with Carpenter. He hated what they did with the script. He wanted his name removed from it entirely. He completely distanced himself from it. And apparently was just a grumpy, horrible person to work with. It was quite, I think John Carpenter was quite disheartened by that. But yeah. Clearly still loved him and his work enough to pay homage to him later on down the line with Prince of Darkness. And yeah, like we say, he called himself Martin Quatermass in the credits for this very strange little film that is Prince of Darkness.
It's one of his plottier films as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, we talk about The Fog, where the setup is quite straightforward. Prince of Darkness, less so, I'd suggest.
Yes, and I think what's interesting about Prince of Darkness, I personally love John Carpenter for all of the reasons we've talked about, the music, the cinematography, the vibe.
The font.
Yeah, the font!
That's back as well, yeah.
And I do feel like some of the plot might go over people's heads in this. There's all kinds of talk about antimatter and quantum physics and all this kind of stuff. But I think generally you can enjoy this film for its queasy, nightmarish vibe. And it's the characters, it's the scares, it's the atmosphere, it's the music, it's the font, it's everything else, right, that you get in this movie. And I just kind of let it sort of wash over me a little bit, some of these plot points, you know.
It started a month ago.
What started?
A change in the earth and the sky.
Donald Pleasance in it is just unsettling. From the off, he's just massively unsettling, I found.
Yeah, absolutely. He's very good at this. You know, he did this in Halloween a decade earlier as Dr. Loomis, this kind of very ominous, slightly unhinged hero of the story. And yeah, you do think, God, what's going on with this guy? He's very mysterious and very strange, but so much presence. Donald Pleasance has so much presence, doesn't he, in this?
That rhymes. We should go with that. I want rhyming answers to future questions.
All right, exactly. We should call him Donald Pleasance.
He's gaining strength. I can feel it all around us now.
People often talk about the best screen performances from musicians turned actors, and we can't leave Prince of Darkness without mentioning this. So we'll get Bowie, we'll get Whitney Houston, we'll get Prince, we'll get Cher. People just don't talk about Alice Cooper's, I'm more inclined to say, appearance rather than performance in Prince of Darkness, because even though he doesn't have a single line, it's pretty memorable stuff.
Oh my God, yeah, he plays one of these kind of again, this is another interesting, strange plot point to this movie, isn't it? That there are these kind of homeless yes. people and drifters who all seem to be kind of possessed by this evil and are surrounding this church that our main characters are in. So it means that they can't leave, essentially. Every time they leave, they will be killed by yeah. one of these people outside. And Alice Cooper plays this kind of creepy, murderous drifter, essentially, right? And it's a performance. It's a good performance. He's very creepy in that role.
Yeah.
But again, I wonder whether by this point in his career, after this incredible streak, John Carpenter was very easily able to kind of pick people like this for his movies, for his weird little cult movies, you know?
One of the reasons I wanted to focus on Prince of Darkness a little bit, though, is a little bit of what you said, really. The sheer tone of it is an absolute masterclass. I mean, you look at how long the opening credits go on for instance, and how little dialogue there is in the opening 5-10 minutes. It's almost like he's ripping up an imaginary rulebook here.
It's amazing, isn't it? I first saw Prince of Darkness in the cinema, actually, because it came back. I think it was at the BFI South Bank. They kind of did a John Carpenter season,
yeah.
and I made a point to go and see Prince of Darkness because I had never seen it. And it was a great way to experience it, actually, on the big screen, because, again, the mood, that tone, that really prolonged opening sequence when we're just sort of watching people go about their day.
Yes.
But there's this kind of ominous music. There is this real feeling of dread.
The repetition of it, yeah.
Oh, it's wonderful. And you don't necessarily know what this story is, where it's going, what you're in for, but you feel like Carpenter is completely in control and is going to yeah. take you on this ride, you know, and you get all of that from that opening 5 or 10 minutes.
It's the film that he presumably could only have made at the end of the 80s when he had the experience and the know-how rather than in the 70s.
It definitely feels like that. It feels like one of those weird movies a director wants to make something almost for himself, you know?
Yeah.
I think it took a while for people to kind of appreciate it. And I think now, you know, a lot of people kind of cite it as one of their faves of his. But it's certainly a strange one. It's not as, like you say, it's not as instantly as accessible as a movie like The Fog, I would say.
There is a signal broadcast every second of every day through our television sets. Even when the set is turned off, they want benign indifference. They want us drugged. We could be pets. We could be food. But all we really are is livestock.
If we can move on to They Live, I adore They Live, but I mean, we talk sometimes when we talk about horror cinema and sci-fi cinema about subtle underlying subtexts of movies. And I'm going to suggest, as much as I'm fond of They Live, that the subtext wasn't really very sub in this one. I think that's the posh film critic way to say it. This was not his most subtle film, was it? I mean, can you tell us about what he was going for there?
Yeah, so this is, you're right, there's nothing too subtle about They Live. So this is the story of a man played by Roddy Piper.
We're coming to him. Yeah.
We'll come
Rowdy
to him.
Roddy Piper, thank you.
And essentially, he sort of finds himself wandering about this town with these sunglasses that let him see hidden subliminal, well, not again, not very subliminal, but these kind of hidden messages everywhere, essentially, from government, from corporations, that kind of thing, you know, these big signs and placards that say consume, obey, this kind of thing. And essentially he comes to realize that the world is being run by these alien overlords. They're kind of hiding in plain sight, and that only he is able to see what's really going on.
Look, lady, we're in trouble. The whole world's in trouble. They're all around us and we never knew it. You can only see them with these special glasses. I swear to you, we're being controlled by these things. I don't know what they are or where they came from, but we gotta stop them.
All right.
Like you said, there's nothing really subtle about this film. I think Carpenter felt angry in this film and he wanted the world to know he was angry. You know, I kind of get that feeling watching this movie.
Yeah, I see that. And then I also see, I mean, we're talking about unusual casting. So Rowdy Roddy Piper was, with due respect to him, and I know we've lost him now, nobody's first choice for a movie in the 80s. We're conditioned to wrestlers appearing in films now. I mean, we got Hulk Hogan in Gremlins 2 once upon a time, depending which version you watch. But this was even left afield than Alice Cooper, wasn't it?
It was, wasn't it? And I know next to nothing about wrestling and famous wrestlers, to be honest. And when I first watched the film, I had no idea that that's what he was known for at the time. But yeah, he's a strange choice for the hero of this movie, isn't he? He doesn't have to do a lot. He kind of wanders around reacting to things. And then there is a very, very prolonged sort of fight scene, right? A punch-up in an alley, which feels like it takes up about a third of the movie.
Look, you crazy mother.
Put these on.
Hey! Stay away from me!
I'm telling you, you dumb son of a...
It goes on longer than the opening credits of most Carpenter films.
It's so funny. It just goes on and on, this fight with, again, like frequent Carpenter collaborator Keith David.
Yeah.
If you're going to put Roddy Piper, I guess, in your movie, let's see him do a bit of fighting, I guess.
I'm trying to save you and your family's life.
You couldn't even save your own!
I think we're selling it short, though, because this particular sequence in They Live comes up as one of the finest action sequences of American cinema in the 1980s. And I'm fully behind that. But Mike Munzer, are you?
I am, actually. I am, yeah. It's visceral, isn't it?
Like, it's breathtaking.
It's breathtaking. It doesn't feel like you're watching stunts. It doesn't feel slick or too produced or too edited. It feels like you're just dropped into an alley watching these two people punch the living daylights out of each other, right?
Yes.
You really feel it. I do. I agree with that. I think it is one of the most visceral fight scenes in cinema. I love it.
I told you, I didn't want to be in.
It's a really fun film. It really is. Like, it's, again, there's a really fun tonal balance in this. But I would say more than Prince of Darkness and The Fog, it's more comedy, it's more satire than it is horror. But you have also got all these kind of alien creatures and a lot of other great stuff going on. I mean, it's a really fun movie.
So I would be tempted to double bill The Fog with Prince of Darkness. But also, then I'd be tempted to double bill They Live with Escape from New York. Two films that feel very much like reaction to politics of their era. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would say so. You know, Escape from New York and They Live definitely feel like his most overtly political movies, don't they?
Yeah.
And yeah, Prince of Darkness is a good double bill with this movie too, just tonally, I would say. You know, I think start with Prince of Darkness as something a little bit more thought-provoking, a little bit darker, a little bit more baffling, and then you can watch something that is a bit more fun and surface, but in a wonderful way.
Attention, you are now entering the debarkation area. No talking, no smoking. Follow the orange line to the processing area. The next scheduled departure to the prison is in 2 hours. You now have the option to terminate and be cremated on the premises. If you elect this option, notify the duty sergeant in your processing area.
So with Escape from New York, the context of that was more a reaction to Watergate, and They Live was more a reaction to Reagan.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, Carpenter's always had this really interesting thing that he talks about in interviews about the nature of evil and the two different types of evil. And he says, you know, people sit around the campfire and they tell a story about an evil presence. And one type of evil is the type that you get out there in the woods, the outside force coming in. But the other type of evil is the evil within the group of people sat around the campfire kind of thing. And I think you can see that really clearly in all of these films that we've talked about, this balance of, yes, there may be some evil monsters, you know, there is an external evil or an external force, but then there is also something maybe even more insidious within, you know, that's kind of hidden. And I think, you know, Carpenter always loves kind of juggling that in most of his movies too.
When we just chatted about Prince of Darkness, one of the things we talked about was the repetition of the score. And we can't talk about John Carpenter, the filmmaker, without talking about John Carpenter, the musician, to be behind not just classic films, but classic film scores as well. Do you have any particular favourites amongst his scores?
Oh my God, I love them all. You know, I don't know if you do this, Simon, but I find John Carpenter music really nice to listen to while writing as well. Like, I always have to, if ever I'm writing anything, I can't listen to music with lyrics because I find it too distracting. But I love listening to John Carpenter scores. I have the playlist on repeat, but I actually love The Fog. The Fog is one of my faves. And I really love Prince of Darkness, actually. You know, again, that opening repetition, that opening music that we get in that prolonged intro sequence. Obviously, Halloween is such a classic, iconic, simple, but such a scary score as well.
Yeah.
And I actually really like the score that he did for Halloween 3, Season of the Witch as well. But yeah, it's and Christine as well. Oh, there are so many good ones. There are so many good ones. I love them all. What about you? Do you have a fave?
Well, I'm just thinking the sinister nature of your writing is really coming through now. Now we understand why.
Exactly.
I was really taken with Prince of Darkness, actually. That was the last of his films of that run that I came to. Mm-hmm. And it just has repeated in my head. But I'm like you. I kind of cycle between quite a few of them. But for want of not appearing like I'm sitting on the fence, at the moment, it's Prince of Darkness.
There's that quite comedic music for They Live as well, which kind of feels a bit Western, but it also feels a bit goofy. That kind of bow, 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 you know, everywhere he goes. It's hilarious, yeah.
I'm hugely impressed that you turn that into audio gold for us there, Mike.
That's what I think of. When I think of They Live, I just think of 90 minutes of bow, 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 and Roddy Piper walking around with sunglasses, basically.
Why then has John Carpenter's work endured in the way that it has? Because we're talking about a lot of films that weren't well received when they first came out. And yet we sit here 30, 40 years on talking of them as classics, semi-classics, certainly in that conversation.
It's really interesting, isn't it? And I think we've seen maybe more than any other horror filmmaker, his influence on filmmakers today. You know, I think what we've got now is a generation of horror and genre filmmakers that grew up on John Carpenter. And you see that. You see that in movies like It Follows. See that in movies like The Guest. You know, there are so many movies where you just think, yes, this is just John Carpenter all over. And I don't know why it wasn't as appreciated as it could have been back in the day.
Yeah.
Maybe it's just got something to do with the fact that he belongs firmly in a genre space and people can be sniffy about horror and about genre. And I think these days, especially over the last 10 years or so, there has been a kind of newfound respect for horror in the sort of critical community and amongst audiences as well. You know, that there is this ridiculous kind of notion that horror has become more elevated in recent years. But actually, horror has always been...
Don't
exactly, it's ridiculous.
We have to come up with some explanation as to why we like horror all of a sudden.
It's very strange.
Weird.
And we have had some incredible horror movies over the last few years.
Yes.
You get movies like Get Out that win Oscars, you know, and you've got filmmakers like Ari Aster and Robert Eggers that are doing incredible things with the genre.
Yeah.
But there have always been people doing incredible things with the genre. And there was this particular era in the 80s and a school of filmmakers like George Romero, John Carpenter, Wes Craven, Toby Hooper, that weren't as appreciated as they should have been, and for whatever reason. But finally, thank goodness, they are now all being recognised as the masters that they are. And I think part of that is just generational. Part of it is that we now have a new school of filmmakers who grew up watching all of those movies, you know, those John Carpenter movies on VHS, right? And fell in love with them.
Well, you had James Cameron working on them.
Yeah.
You know, he was practical effects on Escape from New York, right?
Right, exactly. And James Cameron himself has said, you know, many times that The Terminator was inspired by John Carpenter. And essentially, The Terminator is a slasher film. It's Halloween. Halloween, but with a robot, right? And so, yeah, absolutely, that influence has always been there, just in the same way that for so many of those 70s filmmakers, they were inspired by 50s monster movies or 50s serials or whatever it might be. You know, I guess it's always generational, it's always cyclical, but thank goodness that John Carpenter now is very much kind of respected as the master that he is.
So, Mike, before we let you go, one thing we ask of every guest on this podcast is that they dig into the Studio Canal library and come up with their dream double bill. And unsurprisingly, I suspect, you've come up with a pair of horror treats for us.
I have.
You couldn't just do a rom-com, could you, Mike?
I mean, hey, I could argue that one of these two films is a bit of a rom-com.
The floor is yours. I can't wait to hear this.
Well, you know, I was born in 1987, and I also think that 1987 is one of the best years for horror as well. We've already talked about Prince of Darkness. I believe that was 1987. But I've gone with Studio Canal double bill of Near Dark and Evil Dead 2. Both wonderful horror films in very, very different ways. And I think in a lot of ways, they kind of show the scope and the broad appeal of horror. Because with Near Dark, obviously, Catherine Bigelow's vampire western, kind of very moody, noir-y piece about this guy who kind of falls in with a group of vampires, you know, one of which played by Bill Paxton in one of his classic, terrifying, unhinged roles. Woo!
It's finger licking good.
bad, grisly, vampiric stuff happens in that movie. And it's a really brilliant kind of early movie from Kathryn Bigelow.
Well, it's another Oscar-winning director, isn't it, who started in horror?
Exactly. And it's, you know, there are all these stories about how, you know, Kathryn Bigelow wanted to make a Western, couldn't get it made. And then she basically was like, I'm going to make a Western with vampires, and then got it made. Just add vampires into whatever movie you want to make, basically. And I think it doubles its chances of getting made. But it's this really interesting blend of Western and vampire movie. It's got some brilliant performances, and yeah, a really great kind of mood piece, that one as well. And then on the other side of the spectrum, we've got Evil Dead 2 from the same year, which is, again, generally thought of as one of the greatest horror sequels, if not one of the greatest sequels, right? So this is, of course, Sam Raimi's absolutely bonkers, deranged movie starring Bruce Campbell, and for a big chunk of the movie, just Bruce Campbell, alone in a cabin in the woods, going up against zombies and deadites and all kinds of horrible, grisly monsters. He has a fight with his own hand at one point. He has to remove his own hand. There are some amazing kind of visual gags, I suppose you'd call it, and you know, the movie feels as much like a kind of a Three Stooges film as it does a terrifying horror movie. And again, if you want to talk incredible, you know, tonal balance that people like John Carpenter get, Sam Raimi does that masterfully with the Evil Dead movies. Yeah.
But does he have a font, Mike? Does he have a font?
Do you know what? I don't know if he does have a... I mean, there is definitely a font for the Evil Dead films, but I don't think he uses that same font in Spider-Man.
Mike Munzer, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's almost it then for this special bonus episode of Studio Canal Presents. You can stream The Fog, Escape from New York, They Live and Prince of Darkness on the Studio Canal Presents channel on Apple TV and Prime Video right now, alongside Mike's double bill picks, Near Dark and Evil Dead 2. And just a heads up, there'll be a bit more Evil Dead chatter to come on this podcast in 2023.
You work for a piece, right?
10,000 up front.
How do we know you're that good?
Get in.
Next time, I'll be exploring Walter Hill's enormously influential 1978 neo-noir, The Driver, which is heading back into cinema shortly before arriving on a 4K Ultra HD Blu-ray disc in December. If you'd like to do your homework before tuning in, a stunning 4K restoration of the film hits cinemas around the UK on Friday, November the 11th.
Some of the criminal types these days, they think that they're real cowboys. Think that they can just drive around, do whatever they want to do, whenever they want to do it.
To find out more about Studio Canal Films and the Apple TV and Prime Video channel, you can visit www.studiocanal.co.uk or follow Studio Canal at Studio Canal UK on Twitter, Instagram and TikTok. I'm just off to select my own personal font now. Thanks for listening. I'll see you back here very soon for the next episode of Studio Canal Presents. Ta-ta for now.